Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Stephen Fenwick Vasecki v. Renee Vasecki from Dallas County. Universal Insurance, Universal Services Company, Incorporated v. Hoai Hang Cao-Hung from Harris County. Syntax Incorporated v. John L. Hall Sr. and others from Harris County. And Laidlaw Waste Systems, Inc. and Eco Land, Inc. v. City of Wilmer from Dallas County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner may reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will complete all the arguments before the lunch break. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and if anyone would like to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. We are now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Vasecki v. Vasecki.
May it please the court, Ms. Joanne Wilkins will present argument with petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Joanne Wilkins and I represent Mr. Vasecki, the petitioner, before this court today. This court must make a decision in this case between applying an established rule of law or creating a new one. The circumstances under which it must do that are tragic and serious. This case started as a divorce action and escalated into a very bitter war about money. And into that war were dropped accusations of sexual abuse. Ms. Vasecki's accusations were that she was sexually abused as a child, but that she repressed these memories and only began recalling them in November of 1990. This recall was, of course, after she started therapy with a therapist who admittedly made suggestions, including, sounds like incest to me, and after a diary entry by the plaintiff herself in July of 1990, where she says, I still have not had any memories of this abuse. So somebody is telling this young woman that she has been abused. There's not any dispute among the experts that false memories can be created and that they do occur. I'm sure the court is aware of many recent publicized cases where people accused of sexual abuse, their abusers have publicly recanted. The most recent would be the Cardinal in Chicago. But I'm not here condoning child sexual abuse, and I'm not here arguing that it doesn't happen. But these are horrible accusations, and the shocking nature of these allegations does not affect this court's judgment in making decisions on legal principles.
Your argument is that even if it's true, it's barred by limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. There's no dispute in this case that her claims are barred by the statute of limitations unless the discovery rule applies. And that's what we're here on today, to determine whether the discovery rule applies. I would submit to this court that it does not, that it cannot meet the considerations and the concerns and the tests that this court has laid down in prior cases. The discovery rule is a rule of accrual. The cause of action accrues when the plaintiff discovers or should discover the nature of her injury. The general rule is that a cause of action accrues when the wrongful act affects some injury, regardless of when the plaintiff may discover it, and regardless of whether the discovery may take place outside the limitations period. In cases where this court has considered application of the discovery rule, it has taken into consideration the inability of the plaintiff to know of an injury within the limitations period. It's also considered whether the case is of a type that is subject to fraudulent prosecution given the nature of the evidence to support the claim, whether the type of case raises a question of the plaintiff's credibility, and whether the issue depends on expert professional judgment or diagnosis or opinion solely to establish the issues. This court has never said that the preclusion of a legal remedy alone is sufficient to apply the discovery rule. In this case, the Court of Appeals did not do any balancing or analysis of these concerns and these factors because it had already ruled in another case that the discovery rule was applicable to childhood sexual abuse claims. There are two cases, three if you count this one, two cases in Texas that discuss the application of the discovery rule to childhood sexual abuse claims where repressed memory is alleged. One is the LC versus AD opinion out of the Dallas Court of Appeals. That court held that the discovery rule is applicable where there's objective evidence of abuse and objective evidence that the repression actually occurred. The other case holds opposite. The San Antonio court held in Sanchez versus Archdiocese of San Antonio that the discovery rule is not applicable. In holding that the discovery rule wouldn't apply in this case, the court stated that the inordinate lapse of time, the imprecise art of psychology and psychiatry coupled with figments of imagination enlarged by the passage of time, and the uncertainty of the present memories of past events require this court to deny application of the discovery rule.
If this claim had been made within 2-year period after this woman reached majority, that is, in other words, let's say her 19th birthday, would you still contend that her claim was barred?
No, Your Honor, because minority told limitations for her until her 18th birthday.
And you're not contesting that at all?
No, Your Honor, I'm not contesting any of the statutory provisions with respect to tolling. I would submit that that repression as alleged here is not a mental incapacity such that would toll the limitations under another statutory provision. That wasn't an issue in this case. But minority did toll it. If she had sued within 2 years of reaching majority, then her claim would have been timely, but it was not.
If application of the discovery rule has so many problems, why have so many state legislatures decided to do it?
I think the state legislatures have addressed this because there are very many concerns with these plaintiffs not having a remedy, but the legislatures are having to address it and are addressing it because the court, the judiciary, says the discovery rule doesn't apply under the rules of law that are applicable in that state, just like here. Under the discovery rule, as it is stated in Texas, the discovery rule does not apply. So it would be, the legislature can take into consideration the injustice, which is what the Court of Appeals in this case is focused on. It can also take into account the competing interests. There are two sides to this story.
But how does it take those interests into account any differently from some method of applying the discovery?
If the discovery rule is to apply in this kind of case, this court might as well just hold that there are no statutes of limitations.
I understand that. I understand that's your argument. But how can the legislature fashion a better remedy than the court can?
Because I think the legislature can specifically limit it to a child sex abuse claim as 26 other states have done. This court, should it hold the discovery rule as applicable because someone has forgotten something, has forgotten a traumatic event? The same injustice in being barred from bringing a claim will exist any time that a plaintiff's claim is barred. Now, if the discovery rule applies, they can excuse that failure to file because by saying, the trauma of my injury, the trauma from your wrongful act caused me to forget. And I would submit, Your Honor, that the theory of repression is not widely accepted. It is hotly debated in the scientific and psychological communities. There are questions about the authenticity and reliability of recovered memories. There's no way to test whether a recovered memory is true or false.
Let me follow up on that as well, because you've got the standard for discovery now is the nature of the injury is such that the person can't discover that injury until some point in the future. Why, and you may have answered this, but if the scientific community recognizes, or a segment of the community recognizes, that a trauma can be so significant that the person is incapable of recalling the perpetrator of the trauma. Under our current analysis of discovery, isn't that person just as incapable of discovering the injury as a person who's been under anesthesia and the doctor leaves a sponge in and they don't discover that until later on in medical treatment down the road? Can't that same sort of concept be applied here to the repressed memory issue? The trauma is so significant that it is tantamount to someone who is incapable, who was not aware or could not recall what has happened.
Well, that is the plaintiff's argument, Your Honor. Repression is not that I didn't know that it happened, like leaving a sponge in the case. Repression is the mind's way of dealing with what you know. You do know this. It's causing you problems. You can't deal with it, so the mind gets away with it. And under the test for applying the discovery rule, it's the discovery of the wrongful act. And I would submit that childhood sexual abuse is not inherently undiscoverable, which is the test that this court has fashioned. I understand the dilemma of the court when it faces a claim that I didn't remember this until it was too late to sue within the limitations period. That is an injustice that every one of the courts that has ruled on this issue has looked at. But even with that injustice and balancing that against all the other factors, the majority of the courts have held that the discovery rule doesn't apply in these kind of cases. I think the discovery rule doesn't apply in this case under the test that I believe this court has set out, and I don't believe it meets the test that the Court of Appeals crafted for the objective requirement, even if this court would adopt that test, because what they looked at is the scientific evidence, which is subjective. It is a personal opinion of these people based on what they have been told. And what they have been told are the subjective assertions by the plaintiff. There is
the policy rationale for limitations generally is that it's unfair for a person to be called upon to defend a claim so long after it has occurred. A witness's memories are dim, they've dispersed, documents have been destroyed, and that sort of thing. But isn't the problem that your client would have exactly the same as if this claim had been made when the complainant turned 19, during a time in which you concede that limitations would not have barred the claim? What's magic about another year passing and the application of the discovery rule in terms of the burden that a defendant would have defending a claim like this?
I would submit to you that the burden in any of these claims is going to be very difficult when you're dealing with claims of an abuse over a long extended period of time. But our legislature has made a determination giving people a reasonable amount of time to bring a lawsuit. These claims are subjective, and there is no objective evidence, verifiable evidence in this case. It's not going to exist. where things have been said that could be checked, they have been checked. But that's not, I remember at 2, this happened. There's no one but the plaintiff that is saying that. And what she had said in this court, what she said in the trial court, and what's not in the Court of Appeals opinion, is a discussion about what the plaintiff actually did testify to, and that's that her testimony is not accurate, that her written memories are 50% wrong, and the jury can't trust what she said. How is anybody going to defend against something like that? Is the jury supposed to make a decision on that kind of testimony? This was a competency question that was addressed in the trial court. And
you take issue with LC, though, that it shouldn't be a discovery rule with objective in this year, but it should be no discovery rule at all.
I don't believe that there should be a discovery rule. I think the Dallas Court of Appeals was trying to address the very valid concerns of the staleness and the subjective nature and the fear of fraudulent claims by requiring this objective evidence. The kind of evidence that they held was objective is what I take issue with. It is not objective evidence. It is that man's personal opinion with respect to what he has been told. And what he has been told are the same memories that the plaintiff testified weren't accurate. I don't know how more subjective you can get. Dr. Madigan even admitted two people could look at the same thing and see them differently, and I believe that that is purely subjective.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Please, the court. Mr. Mike Patterson will present argument for the respondents.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here. My first case before this court to represent Renee Brzeski is in this courtroom to discuss a case that's obviously one of first impression. I think it's important in discussing this case to look at the facts. And what we're talking about here is a young woman who underwent 15 years of sexual abuse by her father from up until age 18. And then after she left the home, a few months after her 20th birthday, she began to recall, consistent with what all the experts testified in this case, is what's consistent in literature, slowly began to remember the sexual abuse that was perpetrated on her father. And the issue in this case is whether we are going to apply the discovery rule in the area of repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse. And I think the answer is clear that to do otherwise will be, as some of the courts in the past, shockingly unjust. Now, we can discuss some of the different cases in the ways they've come up with this, and some look at the act, whether it's inherently unknowable. Some, like in asbestos litigation, look at when the injury became knowable. But the bottom line is, it's a question of justice, whether you're going to apply this case, apply the discovery rule to allow this woman to have her day in court, or whether you're going to do as the dissent did in the 1967 Gaddis case, say although the petitioner did not know it, she undoubtedly had a cause of action the minute the sponge was left in her, and although this produces harsh results, cause of action accrues when it accrues. The
petitioner points out that this is a different situation because the victim, the claimed victim, knows at the time what's happening, as opposed to the person on the operating table who doesn't know. It's not a question of knowing, it's a question of remembering.
Well, that's possible. I'm sorry. That's an issue that's been in hot dispute in this case, whether she knew at the time this was occurring or not. The expert to testify in this case will tell you, and if I can read from my brief on page 21, early sexual abuse causes repression. The dissociation is a defense when somebody is being sexually abused. They literally, during these events, begin to dissociate as if it is not happening to them, and it's a way to maintain their mental stability, what's left of us. Otherwise, they'd be unable to function. In other words, Dissociation is when you actually, your mind leads your body because you cannot comprehend what's happening to you. And what the experts testified in trial is that when this traumatic sexual abuse occurs, and the earlier it occurs, and the closer the relationship, like a father-daughter, the more likely this is going to occur. So the person does not really know at that time what is occurring. Now this is
Mr. Patterson, let me, following up on that, Ms. Wilkins, if I understand one of her points, the legislature could determine that in the area of child abuse, this is so significant that we will just not have a statute of limitations on child abuse. The legislature could do that, I suppose. But her point is to come to the court and say, we want the court to fashion a remedy. All it amounts to is for the court to say that if you can establish that you couldn't remember that you were injured, that then the statute of limitations does not begin to run until you remember you were injured. How does that, how can the court fashion a remedy? How can the court provide justice, in your words, here, without effectively saying that anybody can get around a statute of limitations if they predicate their claim on the fact that the trauma was so significant that I just don't remember, or just didn't remember until within 2 years of when I filed my lawsuit? How do we do justice here, but not do injustice at the other end?
Well, by simply stating that this case is limited to areas where we have repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse, period.
So you see no problem with the court saying that just as a matter of public policy for child abuse, there'll be one standard for statute of limitations, and in all other areas there'll be a different standard?
Well, I don't think there's a different standard. The discovery rule is taken on a case-by-case basis and looked at individually. And the argument that's being presented here is the same one that's presented every time. In Gaddis, for example, they're talking that this would obliterate not only the statute of limitations of medical malpractice, but all other tort actions. So this is an old argument that has been frequently rejected by this court. What the issue that you are dealing with here right now, that all the courts have had to deal with, is can I accept the fact that there can be repressed memories of sexual abuse?
What is troubling is that for purposes of therapy, a psychiatrist or psychologist accepts everything as true. And how does that interact with establishing whether or not it is true?
Well, what the, I think it was the psychiatrist, Dr. Madigan, testified is that when somebody walks in my office, I do not act like a police investigator and start questioning them. I listen to them, I accept what they're saying. And if it's true over a period of time, and in this case 20 sessions with this man, and the licensed professional counselor, 82 sessions with that woman, it hangs together. It's consistent with what the literature says. It's consistent with what they've seen in other people.
Well, but it's my understanding that even if perhaps the therapist believes it's not true, it's true as far as the patient goes. That's my understanding of how therapy proceeds. And I think that it is a problem with establishing whether, in fact, this did occur.
Well, what you're getting into now is what's commonly called the false memory syndrome, which, incidentally, they filed a brief with the court here yesterday, less than 24 hours before we were to argue. I don't know what the procedure of the court is. But if you're going to consider this issue shortly, obviously I will not have an opportunity to respond to that, and I've filed a motion to strike. But
The false memory syndrome is another attack on this. It's widely debated in the literature, and I can discuss with you whether I think that that has any credibility or not.
Well, the court's not in the habit of striking amicus briefs whenever they come in, so if you want to file a written response to this, of course, maybe.
Well, I understand. I appreciate that. I did file a little something with it.
But it seems that that debate in the scientific community presents the very issue that you worry about its limitations, which is are we keeping the cause of action close enough to the event that we're minimizing lost memories, lost witnesses, stale claims, that sort of thing?
Well, all that we're asking for, and instead of this court, on the basis of, how should I say, somewhat antiseptic evidence, deciding whether or not this woman will even have her day in court, because the whole idea of repressed memories is a little difficult for me to understand or accept, why not at least allow her her day in court where they can come in and they can present experts from all over the countryside talking about false memory, why this couldn't have occurred, like we do in all other cases?
Well, as you point out, those are the kinds of arguments that are made in every discovery rule case. But we need to try to find out why this one's unique, or why these circumstances are unique. Otherwise, we just apply the discovery rule in every case.
Well, I think if you look at some of the factors that courts have considered in the past in determining this rule, and one is just the justice or injustice of it, to allow a person to be sexually abused for 15 years, and the more horrendous that abuse, the more traumatic that abuse, the more likely that person is not going to know what happens until later on. No man should be able to benefit from his wrongdoing.
Will you agree?
That's the kind of message we're sending here.
Mr. Patterson, under your theory, if your client had repressed this memory until a time at which her abuser had died, she would have a cause of action against his estate, wouldn't she?
Yes.
And I guess that really, my concern is how does one defend against a claim like this? If we're concerned, as we are, with doing justice, we must be concerned with doing justice to both parties. And how does one defend a case like this?
Well, number one, in this case, the father, the perpetrator, is still alive.
Right.
Number two, I mean, this court, we've had other cases, any kind of case, car wreck cases where somebody dies, and the courts just have to deal with it as it is.
Well, presumably there weren't, I don't know, were there any other witnesses, or is it just a matter of the alleged abuser saying, I didn't do it, and the child, now the adult, saying it happened?
Well, unfortunately, incest doesn't occur on the 50-yard line at Cowboy Stadium, and we just don't have witnesses. And that's one of the reasons this crime is so traumatic, and why people like Renee Viseski need protection, because when they do reach their adulthood and they're able to recover these memories, they ought to be able to come in the court. Now, some of the things that this court has looked at in determining whether to apply the discovery rule is, as I've said, is just whether it's just or not. But the other thing is the relationship between the parties. In the Willis Maverick case, they looked at the attorney-client relationship and said this is a special fiduciary relationship in which we are going to apply the rule. And what we're talking about here is a father-daughter relationship. I can't think of any more special relationship than a parent and child. This relationship is recognized in our family code, where we have a statutory duty by parents to protect and take care of their children. So I think that's another thing to consider in applying this rule.
Would your rule apply in physical abuse cases?
Well, the case that we have before the court is one of sexual abuse, Your Honor.
I'm trying to explore how far it reaches. So my question is, would it apply in physical abuse cases?
Well, I'm not prepared to discuss that. I think that we should just limit it to childhood sexual abuse case situation, which we have here. We have all kinds of expert testimony on that, and I'd rather not get into attempting to discuss how we might extend that. I think that should be taken on a case-by-case basis. If somebody thinks they've got enough evidence and brings it before a court, then this court or whatever other court takes it up can consider it at that time.
Is there any rationale for not extending?
Well, I imagine that if you pulverize a child so traumatically that that person represses that memory and dissociates, then there may be a application discovery rule there. I think this court, when you look at imposing the discovery rule, sometimes it's difficult to accept some of these psychological and psychiatric principles. I know the first time I heard about this, I found it difficult to understand how this could happen. And it was only after looking at the literature, as the people that testified in this case did, the experts, looking at other cases, do you come to understand that this is a well-recognized, unfortunate example of what happens when we have childhood sexual abuse. I think one other thing that the court is wrestling with, or other courts have wrestled with, is the concern of fraud or somebody just coming along, as the petitioner has suggested in her brief, to suddenly say, "I forgot," and the floodgates open. I think that indicates a lack of real understanding of what goes on in this case. That for a child to get up and accuse her father of perpetrating things that we don't even want to talk about, that are embarrassing to say the least, where the child has a great deal of guilt and blame on herself, indicates a lack of understanding of this issue. You look at...
Counsel, Ms. Wilkins told us a few minutes ago that this began in the divorce case between the perpetrator and the victim's mother. Is that where the case started?
Well, her parents were going through a divorce, and during the pendency of that divorce, Renee Vaseski began to remember their sexual abuse as a child. This was not where there was a custody battle. And the experts in this case...
She was too old to be involved as far as custody is concerned.
Right.
But her memory was jogged by her parents' divorce case, is that what it was?
No, the facts indicated that she was off in Nashville going to college. They said with her being removed from her father, where she was able finally to be free from him and relax, that oftentimes when you separate from your molester, that is often the time when you start to recall these incidents of abuse. And that's what happened in this case, that she went off there, she came back. She went back there, and then her second semester, or first semester of her second year, things just began to unravel. And after that, she dropped out of school, and a couple months later, filed this lawsuit.
Is there a claim that your client's mother was aware of this abuse or unaware?
Her mother was not sued.
My question is there an allegation that she was aware or unaware?
I think during the course of therapy, there were incidents that were recalled by Ms. Vaseski or her, her mother may have been aware of some things.
Well, if not, let's take this hypothetically. Would a child who has grown into adulthood who recalls finally an abuse situation like this, I presume they would have a cause of action against not only the abuser, but perhaps also against the other parent who is aware of abuse but failed to stop it.
That's a possibility, yes.
But now, this case is not a divorce case. This is not the same title or number. This is a separate cause of action that she filed after the divorce case. Is that true?
She intervened in the divorce.
This
and
is
was
the divorce case that where she intervened.
And then it was severed out, as I recall. The divorce was settled, and this case was severed from the divorce.
Is the divorce case still pending?
No, the divorce case was concluded, and then this case was tried sometime after that. This is not the type of case where you get into battle over children and then allegations of abuse surface.
I believe what Ms. Wilkins said, though, it was a battle over money.
Well, Ms. Wilkins said a few things that I can only...
I'm giving you an opportunity to respond.
Pardon me?
I'm giving you an opportunity to respond.
Okay. Well, I disagree with that. I mean, that gets into what I was saying earlier, that obviously anybody that comes into court that's been injured is seeking money. In that respect, it's true. But I think that also, that shows a lack of misunderstanding of these type of cases. That for someone to go to a counselor for 82 sessions, to see a psychiatrist for 20 different sessions, to be put on all kinds of medication, to drop out of school and functioning at a level where they can barely function at all.
During these 82 times and 20-something times, over what period of time did that occur?
That was, I think, a couple years. I mean, she's still seeing people.
Well, does that count times that occurred since the case was filed?
Yes.
How many times did she been to the psychiatrist before the case was filed?
I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, she was in therapy before she filed the lawsuit. She continued in therapy, going 2-3 times a week with some counselors, seeing a psychiatrist, underwent a battery of tests.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilkins, is there accepted in the scientific community this disassociation from an event? Is it accepted, at least among certain segments of the scientific community, that an event can be occurring and the victim of the event disassociates themselves from it, so it's almost as if they're kind of outside of that?
Dissociation is in the same hotly disputed area as repression. Dissociation, I think, has been misunderstood in this court and maybe even in the trial court. I understand it from what I have read that it is a stepping back and not experiencing the emotion and the pain even while observing what is going on. What I heard Mr. Patterson tell this court is that it is an out-of-body experience where you don't know. But I would ask this court, how do you forget something you don't know?
Well, how does a 2-year-old who suffered sexual abuse remember an event like this?
Well, that is a very good question, because the scientific literature on memory generally conclude that two-year-olds don't remember anything.
Why shouldn't, if they recall it later on during their adulthood, have a claim for that?
Well, because I don't think that a two-year-old is going to recall what has been recalled in this case, what the testimony is in this case, the detail, that it was occurring. All of this these are all meshed together, and that's what makes this so terribly hard to defend against. And I would submit to you that false memories are just as real to the people that have them. They require just as much therapy and treatment as real ones. And so I don't think therapy, other than how it made these claims come into being, really has any relevance. How much you get is not the test. And I do want to stress to this court that these are only unsubstantiated claims that are based on inaccurate memories of the plaintiff. Mr. Vasevsky denies this, he has denied it, and he will continue to deny that this has occurred. These are horrible allegations. Yes, it is probably very difficult to stand up and say that your father did this, but can you imagine how difficult it would be to hear that from your child's mouth? I think that the court has addressed the problems that are involved in this case and the concerns and the competing interests that are involved. And if there are no other questions, I thank the court for its attention.
I just have one more question. I wonder, Ms. Wilkins, would the law's focus be better directed on the nature of the repressed memory syndrome and the expert testimony that would be offered, and whether that has general acceptance in the scientific community? We were urged yesterday in arguments to apply the Daubert rule by the United States Supreme Court as articulated. And I wonder if perhaps, as opposed to a discovery issue, whether it's really a matter of the qualifications and the quality of scientific knowledge relating to this repressed memory syndrome that is a more appropriate focus for the law. Do you have any comments on that?
I would think that the reliability of this kind of evidence is certainly an issue, and I think it's, although it is an issue under Daubert, I think it's also an issue under the discovery rule because of this court's holding in Robinson. And I think the same kind of concerns or the same kind of test that Daubert has established and that have been addressed in cases following it can probably be looked at here because of the necessity of relying on expert evidence.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court will take a brief recess.
Rise, please rise.